Hello, it's Wednesday 9th of September. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson.
And I'm Gary Bowerman from Check In Asia.
On this week's show, we're searching desperately for a viable model to reboot travel in the region and asking, is there more that could actually be done?
Yep, we've canvassed opinions on some alternative ideas to get tourism kick-started. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So, where do travel and tourism go from here in Southeast Asia? 2020 is very much looking like it's a no-go, and large parts of the travel industry could well go with it.
Yeah, the options are certainly narrowing, particularly as China's October Golden Week will be a bust for the region this year.
Mm-mm.
Ordinarily, destinations, airlines, hotels, resorts, retailers, F&B outlets, and tour providers across the region will be preparing for a huge influx of Chinese travellers.
Yes.
To be closely followed afterwards by the Christmas and New Year travel periods.
Mm-hmm.
But it ain't going to happen this year, is it, Hannah?
It would be maybe miraculous right now for China to suddenly turn around and decide that they're going to open up in just a few weeks' time.
Yeah, don't see it happening. I really don't see it happening. And I think Bali probably showed that. You know, we'll come to Bali in a moment, but I think that was really kind of the defining point that we won't be expecting Chinese travellers in the region in October.
Definitely. So before we look at the reopening approaches that have been discussed and those that have been rejected, let's look at a very basic but crucial question. Why do some countries want to reopen and some don't?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I have the answer to this, Hannah. I mean,
really?
Every country would like to reopen, of course, because what has been so brutally highlighted this year is the economic importance of tourism around the world.
Yep.
That's something we saw in this region over the last decade or so, really, really increased in its economic importance. But if we go back to other regions of the world, you know, Europe, we'll come to that in a moment, that reopened for its summer.
Yeah.
But the key periods for travel, as we just mentioned there, the Chinese October Golden Week, coming up to Christmas, they don't look like they're going to open. Some countries are trying, some countries aren't.
Yes.
But what are the reasons? Well, I guess if you look at the basic reasons is that some countries are looking to protect their citizens and their public health situations.
Yeah.
Some countries have controlled the virus better than others.
Mm-hmm.
Some were starting to see cases rising a little bit again.
Yes.
Myanmar and Malaysia, two cases there. And then there's the economic needs, which, you know, we all know in our industry just how desperately we need tourism to reboot on an economic basis.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it is also revolving around whether or to what extent a country's GDP is reliant on tourism. So, you know, for countries like Thailand, where that GDP reliance is a lot higher, you've had the PM, the Thai Prime Minister, come out recently and say, you know, the country needs oxygen to breathe. And by oxygen, he means reopening up the country. So there is that realization that they do need to reopen to be able to stimulate the economy. But it's all just weighed against this human cost, isn't it? It all comes down to balancing jobs with health, doesn't it, ultimately?
Yeah, it does. And it also comes down to balancing the precarious nature of this virus.
Yeah.
You know, not every country is in the same situation. If they were, these questions would be a lot easier to answer.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly in our region, we have such diversity in terms of how countries are managing population densities, the spread, the R numbers, these kinds of things. They all have an impact.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult for a country just to say, well, we're going to open, and then find countries which are going to share the same objectives in terms of achieving that.
And I think that probably leads us nicely then to talking about one of the regions which has reopened and in theory should have a more unified approach, which is Europe.
Yeah, well, the European summer is so economically important. But, you know, as we've seen, the coronavirus outbreaks, particularly in some countries of mainland, so Italy, France, Germany, Spain, the UK too.
Yeah.
You know, these were such deep-rooted outbreaks. They caused such death and destruction and quite close to the summer season as well that actually reopening was always fraught with risks.
Yes.
And we're seeing that that seems to have been the case. That Europe has this open border policy, the Schengen Agreement. UK is not a part of that, but mainland Europe has these open borders.
Mm.
And there was obviously a lot of political as well as economic pressure to retain that.
Yes. Yeah, and we've just seen, I mean, I think what's interesting with Europe, I was reading earlier, is that there's actually a shift in the cases. So it's now that more younger people are getting infected rather than older people. So presumably that, you know, that they reason that older people are still taking these kind of precautions, whereas younger people are kind of throwing it to the wind, and with things like nightclubs being open and everything else, that's kind of encouraging this local transmission. Also, just relaxed restrictions and locals, you know, not following everything as strictly as possible. Maybe it's just that summer feeling, you know, you're feeling free, you don't want to wear a face mask. I don't know.
The whole region does live for summer, lives for summer holidays. You know, some countries of the region shut down for more or less for a month.
Yes.
But of course, it's economically important as well. France and Spain are two of the most visited countries in the world. It's important for their economies to be able to reopen.
Yes.
But it does look as the figures are starting to show that actually that reopening, the demand wasn't there in terms of what they were hoping for.
Yeah.
And that bodes pretty badly for the winter ahead.
I think Europe is perhaps, it's maybe not an example of how not to reopen, but certainly it hasn't shown that reopening can go very smoothly.
I think history will read that it was done too soon.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that, because it's the knock-on effects. It's not just the cause of what will happen in summer. It's the prolonging of the effects of coronavirus through into the winter season.
Yeah, and of course, winter season is when you get flu and everything else in Europe.
Yeah.
It's not a good combination.
No, and you combine that with the way China, you know, China has a hot summer season. It's a big holiday season, but they lock the borders down throughout the summer.
Yes.
In the hope that maybe during the winter that the economy will be stronger.
So another country that has reopened recently, and it is Europe, yes, but it is an island, Iceland. So Iceland are again a kind of interesting one, aren't they? Because they had announced quite early on that they were going to reopen to international visitors. And they reopened on June the 15th with a choice. So they told travellers you could either have a COVID test on arrival and pay $110 in the process, or you could choose to do a 14-day quarantine. Now, of course, I imagine most people arriving would have gone for the coronavirus test, but they started to see a small outbreak again.
Yeah.
I mean, and this was in the low hundreds, but that's now prompted a whole policy change, hasn't it? So from mid-August, they have now changed it. So it's a 14-day quarantine or a double testing procedure where you get tested on arrival. You have to quarantine to 5 to 6 days, and then you have to take another test at the end of that before you're free to go off on your merry way. So even with Iceland, they're kind of showing that test on arrival model maybe doesn't work.
What's happened in Iceland is quite relevant to the wider Asia Pacific region, particularly countries like New Zealand and Australia. You know, they're large countries with relatively small populations, small density. But it isn't really just about the population, it's about the people that come in.
Yes.
And that you've got to protect your own population against that. And testing has not really proved that effective in this case.
Yes.
But I think everybody hoped that Iceland was taking a sensible approach. Mm. And there weren't huge numbers of incoming travellers, that it could be controllable. But this virus is just, it's beating us all, isn't it?
It is, it is. Again, we turn a little bit closer to home. We've got Maldives, the example of Maldives reopening. So they opened 15th of July. And again, since they've reopened, they've had an increase in cases. Now, again, this is not a massive spike. But what they have seen is that there are infections of local staff in the resorts as well since they've reopened. So from the 10th of September, so that is tomorrow, passengers will now need a negative certificate at least 72 hours ahead of arrival to be able to enter the country. And I was actually a little bit surprised that they didn't already have this testing requirement on arrival, right?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, Maldives was an interesting case simply because of its geography. It's, you know, it tends to be one resort per island. Mm-hmm. It's this archipelago of separate islands where you should be able to some degree, isolate people, but none of the concepts that we imagine would work seem to work.
Right.
Because of the virus.
Yeah.
I mean, that brings us to our region. I think we'll talk briefly. Mm. We've talked about these both before,
but you know,
the Bali case and Phuket in particular, trying to create this bio bubble.
Yeah.
It hasn't started. Why is that? Why hasn't it started? I think there are a number of reasons. Mm. One is just the way that it's been administered and the bureaucracy behind it. It hasn't really been a clear policy all the way through. Bali at least tried to have a clear policy. It just didn't work.
Yeah.
Phuket's policy, I'm still not sure if we actually know what it really is. It seems to be now into four different phases. But that just doesn't give confidence for travellers to come.
No.
And it doesn't give confidence for people who live on the island or who work there, because a lot of people who work there probably don't actually ordinarily wouldn't live on Phuket.
Exactly. And then you've also got the issue of local tourists wanting to visit those areas and perhaps cancelling their plans, like we've seen in Phuket with domestic tourists cancelling plans to go to Phuket in October because they're worried that maybe international tourists are going to be there at the same time. So you're right, it's just this whole uncertainty which really doesn't help.
And I'm still not entirely clear what the actual objective of the Phuket idea is. I know that we've said before that islands can be used to, as test cases.
Yeah.
But this idea that it will be long-stay tourists only,
yeah.
the length of the quarantine, the restrictions on what you can actually do when you come in, and the cost. I mean, it really limits down to the people that can travel on this basis. I don't really understand how that works for the rest of the Thai tourism industry. As you mentioned there, Hannah, you know, it probably inhibits the domestic sector.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't, does it? Especially if you are a small hotel, you've got no chance of being selected as an alternative state quarantine hotels. You've probably got very little chance of people choosing to stay in your hotel room for 14 days if you don't have, you know, great facilities. It's just very, very limiting. And like you say, the only benefit is going to be to that small select number of hotels who manage to fit this criteria of opening up.
No. And the outcome, which our good friend Shinny from Travel Weekly surmised yesterday in a headline, Phuket tourism teeters closer to breaking point.
Yeah, and I think she's got a point there.
So if we then look at other countries, now some countries seem to be doing exactly the opposite. They are stating quite clearly that they are unlikely to open for the rest of the year.
Yeah.
Add into that list Australia, New Zealand, it seems, Malaysia.
Yeah.
Although today we have this news that Hong Kong is trying to negotiate bubbles with 11 countries, which include those three countries.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of... I mean, people are in discussions, aren't they? But who knows when that discussion... Maybe they're in discussions for 2021.
Entirely. Who knows? Absolutely true. And there's sort of this growing feeling that some countries are waiting for a vaccine now. Do you get that feeling? Yeah. I mean, Indonesia particularly, I think now, has basically decided they're waiting for a vaccine.
Yeah.
Australia seems to be edging towards that way with the number of doses that they've managed to contract.
Yeah, it is. And that's a dangerous game to play, isn't it? Because we still don't know whether these vaccines are entirely effective. They've still not gone through all of the proper certification yet. So to stake all of your hopes on a vaccine being available next year to be able to reopen the country seems to be madness.
Yeah. So let's trademark this one before the media get hold of it, Hannah. I think we're going to move from travel bubbles to vaccine bubbles.
Vaccine bubbles. Ooh, I like that. Yes.
I think that's the way it's going to happen. But, okay, so let's have a look at some alternative models. You know, we're seeing that some of the government and state-run options are falling apart, sometimes for bureaucratic and administrative reasons, some simply because demand isn't there, some because the virus is just proving to beat everybody. Mm-hmm. It's a number of these different factors. Yeah. But that isn't really going to change until a vaccine, perhaps.
But
over the next few months, the industry needs to keep going somehow. Mm-hmm. Now, there is an argument that the countries that are saying for the next 4 or 5 months that we're not going to open, that gives clarity to the domestic tourism sector, which can perhaps slightly pivot and optimize that period. Mm. But it's still not going to meet up for the lost revenues by any means.
It's not.
But going forward, we have to look at other models, don't we?
We do. In one model that I really liked the idea of was Stuart MacDonald. So Stuart MacDonald, we've interviewed him before. He's from Travel Fish. He always has a lot of very forthright opinions that Gary and I really enjoy. Yeah.
Based in Bali.
And he came up with this really, which I thought quite interesting idea. So he said, rather than try to target the luxury market, instead you should target the budget traveler market. And I think when he's saying budget travelers, he's thinking very much his Travel Fish readers. We can see what you mean, Stuart. But and I think his argument was that these are kind of travelers who really engage with the community, so that they are giving back to the community as well. It was essentially that you are rethinking what a 14-day quarantine means. So he is not saying scrap the 14 quarantine. I think he's almost saying kind of embrace.
Yeah, embellish it.
Yeah, embrace it, embellish it. So he suggests if you're thinking about Thailand, he called it bring Thailand to you. So during this 14-day quarantine, you could learn to cook Thai food, you could learn the Thai language, you could do yoga. And for me, what the really interesting part of this was that you engage the locals to help deliver these courses. Now, you know, he was still saying these could be done virtually. But it's a way of kind of giving back to these locals as well and bringing the locals in, getting them on board with the idea of reopening tourism. He talked about choosing affordable properties, ideally within a few hours of an airport, so you've got kind of that minimal contact. And when it comes to finding those customers, because that, I think, is one of these main arguments that everybody's had, right, about this Phuket plan, about opening up 14 days, who would want to do that? He argues he should get the hotels to identify the previous customers who've already stayed there and reach out personally to these kind of people and invite them in. So it's a much more personalized approach. And in doing that, you're kind of really bringing the community in. He suggested you should choose sustainable accommodation, but accommodation that is truly green, not kind of lip service green, and that this could potentially be a way of revitalizing the tourism sector.
Yeah, he also made an interesting point that actually by doing that, by bringing together budget travelers who tend to engage with local communities and the local communities themselves, you can bridge some of these barriers where there is a bit of a worry about foreign people coming back into the country. I think that's a really, really nice idea. I like the idea of bringing Thailand to the room, somehow doing that. There would be ways of doing that.
Of course.
Introducing cultural elements while people are locked down. I think he said rather than just 14 days of drinking Chang beer.
Watching TV.
It's an idealistic model because travel has become so commoditized in our region. And whether we like it or not, tourism boards, hoteliers, airlines are looking at higher priced and higher value travelers. They also tend to look at more Asian travelers. And this is perhaps moving a little bit back to that Western travel model.
That's true, actually,
That Southeast Asia's travel sector was actually built on, really, in many ways, going back 30 or 40 years ago. But I like the idea of the sustainability. I like this idea of integrating cultures and communities and travelers. We need more of that. Yeah. I also like his idea where he chose, I think it was 10 different locations across Thailand. So you disperse travelers. They're not concentrated in one area.
Yeah.
I guess the other problem with targeting budget travelers at this moment is going to be cost. We don't really know how the airlines are going to come out of this. We don't know what airfares are going to be like.
Yeah.
A lot of budget travelers tend to be long-haul travelers. They spend a lot of time in the region, but we don't know if they're going to be able to afford the airfares.
Yes.
And we don't really know how the healthcare issues, so the insurance issues, you know, would they be able to afford the cost of insurance?
Yeah.
Now, I'm not trying to put too many barriers in front of this because I like the idea very much.
Me too.
And I'm sometimes accused of being a bit negative. But I just think from a commercial side, tourism boards aren't going to think this way, which is a bit of a shame.
Yeah.
I think they could bring elements of this idea into encouraging tourism across the spectrum.
Yeah.
So not just focusing on luxury travelers, not just focusing on budget travelers, trying to get more of the people, the AirAsia travelers, you know, people who go for breaks. If they have time to do 14-day quarantine, which is going to be the issue.
Yeah, right, because it's not only presumably you'd want to spend a bit longer after the 14 days as well, wouldn't you, to actually explore the place? So let's say 21 days even, that's long.
I still think the entire barrier to this is 14-day quarantines because it's, you know, we're not going to travel. Who has 14 days to spend?
Yeah.
It's only going to be for long-haul travelers, for long-stay travelers, and that's why Thailand moved down this route, because there seems to be no way of budging the quarantine.
Yeah. The only thing that I think about this kind of long-stay travellers, because I think Bill Barnett coined it these snowbirds, so this idea of these northern Europeans who are escaping to the Asia for the winter sun, is the very fact of their age.
Very true.
Right? These are in this high-risk age group. Are they actually going to want to travel? So, yes, they do have the money. Yes, they do have the time. So they pick those, you know, they tick those two boxes.
Would they choose Phuket? I mean, we've said this before. Perhaps this is where Bali fell down slightly, because would they prefer to go to Bali? There's a plenty of space you can, you know, you can spread out across Bali a little bit.
Yeah.
It's hard to
right?
say.
It is.
The trouble is we can pick holes in all these different models. And I'm sure that this tourism boards have done the same.
Yes.
They haven't just come up with these ideas. They've tried to find a way to make it work. But what works?
Yeah. So I posted on LinkedIn a couple of weeks ago with Stuart's idea and asked if people had any other ideas as well, and quite a few people had some different, sometimes very different ideas of how tourism could restart. So one of the first replies that was quite interesting was from Nur Ridwan, who I know previously. I used to do sales meetings with him, and he's operations manager at AET Travel Malaysia, which is a travel agency. So Ridwan said his idea was an ASEAN coalition, and he had a few ideas within that. So he said, one, all countries under the coalition need to have a working COVID-19 procedure and similar testing kits used so that the result is accepted anywhere under the coalition. Why? So that we can eliminate the requirements of travellers being quarantined abroad. And if there is the need of quarantine, it can be done in the home country instead. So that would eliminate this requirement of having a long stay, which, you know, isn't cost or time effective for travellers. And two, he said travel bubbles are crucial, but each country needs to determine which destination has lower cases of the virus spreading. And every bubble needs to have the same process, the same procedure in place so that travelling between bubbles is possible. From my point of view, I think that that is spot on. I think that we do need some kind of standardised test. And I was actually thinking earlier, maybe it could even be someone out of the box. Perhaps it could even be someone like IATA, who has a kind of standard test that people need to take before they take flights. And that way it's standardized across all countries on arrival and departure. Who knows how possible that would be? But you need some kind of third-party authority to say, this is the test that we should be using for air travel.
Yeah. He concludes, which again, I totally agree with. Every bubble needs to have the same process, the same procedure in place so that traveling between bubbles is possible. Absolutely 100% agree.
Yeah.
I think the issue with that and also with the ASEAN coalition is it's just 8 months too late. Yeah. We needed this at the beginning to actually get this in place.
Yeah.
Actually, getting ASEAN countries to agree to it now, given the different states of the virus, is very, very difficult. It's an absolutely brilliant idea and 100% agree with all of it. But I just think it's too late now. I know that doesn't help us moving forward.
Yeah, that is true, I think, yes.
Those lost months, we've said this before, Anna, those lost months at the beginning of the virus where ASEAN didn't come together and didn't actually provide some guidance to the whole of the region are really starting to show.
Yep.
So the second idea is from Dirk Singer, who's head of research at Simplifying. And this is an interesting idea. He said to combine charter flights with stays at all-inclusive resorts. So this is similar to the Phuket idea.
Yeah.
Sell a package holiday where everyone on the charter flight is part of it and goes to the same resort. Testing is done on departure. Then the passengers are taken to their resorts where they spend the week. And many package tourists never leave a resort anyway. Combine this with regular testing of staff and biosafety measures, then flying them back when a second test is done on arrival. It's hard to disagree with the idea that charter flights are the way forward.
Yeah, I do like this idea, actually. And like Dirk says, you know, especially to these people who are going to these resort-type places, yes, they probably will spend the time just at the resort. But again, you know, it's that question of how much does this contribute to the community at large and how much does this only benefit that particular resort?
And who would buy in? So you could probably get the airlines to buy in, you could get resorts to buy in.
Yes.
The tourism board probably wouldn't. They may do, but they may not. But the only real way that it's going to actually impact or benefit the community is the people that work at the resorts.
Yeah, it's not going to benefit your tuk-tuk driver who's taking them around, you know, into town. You're not going to be able to have any interaction with locals outside of the resort. You could probably pretty much be anywhere.
But it is a way of starting something.
Yeah, exactly. So another example, and this is again to do with testing, was René Armas-Maes, who is the commercial VP of Jetlink International. He's actually based in Canada. So he said we need effective testing at both ends between low-case routes. And he says actually maybe countries might even be a big word for that. So that's why he's using the word routes. You need good tracking and tracing mechanisms, digital health forms, multi-stakeholder bio-certifications, random audits, continuous monitoring and vigilance.
Does show how much the world has changed.
Yes, this was definitely not something we'd have talked about 9 months
ago. 7 or 8 months ago. So Kylie Tan, director of Mosaic International, who helps clients enter the Southeast Asian market, I think continuous testing would be the way forward. Mandatory testing carried out every day during the visitor stay. If we can cut the testing to below 1 hour and allow the hotels to run it, it should give confidence to staff as well as the visitor. If I were visiting country, I would certainly want to know. It is for both my interests and also the people around me.
Yeah, I find that a pretty interesting idea. I think that many governments around the world are trying to develop this very fast but accurate testing. Then that makes sense. You know, if you can do it and it is a fast turnaround and it isn't too uncomfortable a procedure, then yeah, you go for your hotel breakfast and then you line up and you get a test on the way out.
The only thing that I have to say about testing is that we've had tests that prove to be workable for for a number of months now.
Mm.
And I don't know why these protocols haven't been put in place. Was there a reason? Is it because of numbers? Is it because they're not scalable? Is it actually just managing the testing results?
Yes.
I don't know the answer.
No, I don't. And that leads quite nicely to something that was happening in Indonesia recently. So last week, actually, the WHO warned Indonesia against using these rapid antibody tests as a mandatory requirement for flying, because they said that they actually only have an accuracy rate of 50%, which not only leads to false positives, but it leads to false negatives as well, and people feeling a lot more complacent. You know, yeah. If you've had the test and the test tells you you're not positive and actually you are positive, then you're probably going to take a lot more risks than if, you know, obviously it says you're positive, so you're going to go into quarantine. Really somewhere.
I guess the other thing with testing as well is that you have to, it will definitely place a strong cap on numbers,
mm-hmm.
because you've got people waiting to be tested.
Yes.
And they're going to be in relatively close proximity. So you've got to have a space where you can manage that.
So Javier Bisch, who is a tourism professional based in Vietnam, he questioned, why do some countries have several international airports? So he said, like in Vietnam, you have one in Hanoi and you have another one in Saigon. He said, I understand if you have to go to Hanoi and there's only an arrival into Saigon, it's pretty inconvenient, but actually it could be very helpful for control. Why? Because you can centralize these international arrivals to one airport, you can focus on preparing that airport to receive travelers, you can make sure a hospital is nearby in case someone is sick, you've got this test center, you've got your quarantine, your special apartment for staff working at the airport. So instead of doing everything twice, you can do it just once and everybody is more prepared and everything is on hand. And if you do have case and there is a spread of it, you can control it easier. I think that makes a valid point as well. What do you think, Gary?
I think it's interesting. And I don't disagree. I think so. If you look at a city like Bangkok, you know, you don't maybe need to have two airports functioning in Bangkok right now.
Yes.
With a country the size of Vietnam, you're in danger of just regionalizing tourism. So, you know, if you only have flights into those, so into Hanoi or Ho Chi Minh City, they're a fair distance apart. So you would basically, if you only use one of those, or you use those two, you're basically going to regionalize tourism, which Da Nang would miss out on.
True. Or you've then got that chance of someone who is positive traveling on lots of local domestic flights as well and infecting even more people and having even more exposure.
Yeah. Kuala Lumpur is another example.
Yes.
You know, we have actually two airports, but there's basically three terminals. Maybe that's not necessary.
That's very true. So JF Hurto, who is the Director of Finance and Business Development at Radisson Blu for Indonesia and Thailand, he's based in Bangkok, he said many countries are in a wait-and-see position, but he suggests, one, use solely national airlines to control tourists inbound with strict health and hygiene protocols in place before and during the flight. Centralize your arrivals in one airport. Again, this idea of centralizing it. Have a PCR test certification with a maximum validity of 4 days ahead of departure. A test at the airport on arrival with results available in a few hours. Thermal screenings. All passengers needing to register their details via a smart app, or maybe wearing an electronic wristband. An additional test if they're suspected to be positive. And if that test is positive, then an isolation at an institutional facility for 14 days. And again, this idea of having a standardized test. So we've got some kind of common themes coming out here, don't we, around standardized testing, limiting the entry points to a country.
Yeah, I think those are sensible ideas for somehow rebooting tourism.
Mm.
It just then becomes political within countries of where do you choose the airport? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you do those things? But it should be possible. Mm. Unfortunately, just the examples of Bali and Phuket just show how difficult it actually is.
Yes. And so we had one last suggestion, didn't we, Gary? And this one is a little bit different. This is maybe more towards the luxury market than mass market.
This is Michael Almok, who's CEO of Defineo, a high-value luxury market and marina operator based in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And his idea is a non-air transport bubble. How to open countries again without an air transport bubble? The answer, yachts.
Hmm.
It's not fast and it won't be huge, but it's the perfect way to test the travel bubble protocols. Set some rules. So number one, can only come from a COVID-free destination to a COVID-free destination. Number two, a set of tests ahead of time, including swabs to be sent by air to the receiving country to be tested and confirmed. If a positive result is found by the receiving country after the yacht has left port, you can either turn around or continue and arrive under quarantine on board the yacht at the marina. Number three, at least 14 days at sea travel time. So there's your quarantine.
Mm-hmm.
Number four, special quarantine areas set up in both countries for yachts that come in positive somehow. A dock area away from other yachts that can only be serviced by people in PPE if necessary. Mm-hmm. Number five, deposit to port of $10,000 per person committed to be spent in the country. Will this work? It's limited and controllable numbers. Time at sea plus dual country testing will make it impossible to arrive with the virus without authorities knowing. The 10,000 figure is to sell it to the public and to help them understand the positive impact to the local economy.
Oh, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, yes, yeah, I've got the quarantine concept there. Of course, it is a very high price point, so like we were saying, it's not mass market. But hey, could work, right?
You can bring it non-air transport bubble. And, you know, it brings the sea back into play. We've been talking about cruise ships and we don't really know what's going to happen there and the sort of stigma that cruise travel now holds. But this yacht transport idea, well, it's an interesting one. I like it. I mean, why not? I mean, what I like about that idea is that doesn't have to be the only idea. That could be a part of a strategy of reopening. Yes. And that obviously will be for the luxury market.
Yes.
But yeah, why not? I like that one. Why not?
If I had money, I'd go on a yacht.
I would. 14 days at sea quarantining.
Gary, have you got anything that you want to add?
Well, you know me, Hannah. I tend to pick holes in everything.
Yes.
I do get accused of being a bit negative, but I just try to be realistic.
Mm.
We are in a very deep hole. There's no question of that. Yeah. The industry is really struggling. The region hasn't come up with too many forward-thinking ideas.
True.
I would have to say ordinarily we would be looking to Singapore to provide those, but Singapore's really struggled by the fact of its own problems, but also the problems around it in the other countries that it would open up to. And I think that's the problem. The opening of travel bubbles or any way green lanes, green zones or whatever is limited by the fact they're not scalable.
Yeah.
Countries don't tend to agree on the numbers of people they would allow into their countries, who they would be, how they would test them, how they would quarantine them.
Yeah.
But we've got to find some innovative solutions soon. That's me sitting on the fence saying I don't have an idea.
Yeah. I think for me, it's very difficult, isn't it? But I think it all just comes down to, and I keep saying this, so I'm going to bore our listeners again, with avoiding this pursuit of zero transmissions, accepting that opening up to tourism, you are going to get some cases. I agree with some of the previous readers. We do need standardized testing. You need to use RT-PCR tests, I think, because they have the highest level of accuracy. We saw Bali's rising cases actually is being blamed on this rapid test, in fact. So you need to make sure you're using the right tests if you are testing. It has to be between similar level countries, but not only in terms of case numbers, in terms of transmission, in terms of the protocols that they are already following as well, and in terms of the levels to which residents are actually obeying these protocols, because the locals need to be just as disciplined as the tourists. Of course, you need to be able to have really, really strict tracking and tracing, because I think you have to presume that somebody is going to bring it in. And so if they have brought it in, you need to be able to track that down. Where have they gone? Very, very fast. But like you say, I think quarantines are just not workable.
Yeah.
Right, especially if we're opening up tourism. 14-day quarantine, no one is going to do that.
I agree with that. I mean, of all those ideas that we've heard, there are elements in that patchwork between each of them that would be viable. You know? And it would be really nice if countries could look at different segments of the market and try to introduce elements for each of those. You know, the budget traveler idea, which Stuart put forward, the idea of the yachts, that's a good idea. There is some way that Phuket could be workable if they could actually find a way to do it.
Yes.
But it's the mass market, which is, you know, where most of the money is made, where most of the people travel, that is just so difficult because of the numbers. It's as simple as that.
Yes.
I'm coming around to the conclusion that countries are thinking that it's a vaccine or bust, really. Which is horrible to think. 8 months into this virus, that's where we've got to.
Yeah.
It's going to have to require some countries or some governments with a bit of leadership to try and make this happen. But there are a huge risk of doing that.
Yeah. Nobody wants to be the first
one. Nobody wants to be the first to fail.
No. So that brings us to the end of this week's Project Reopening special edition of the Southeast Asia Travel Show. We hope you enjoyed the show, and as always, we'd love to hear your feedback on what we said or missed out. And of course, your ideas for reopening models as well, please. So email us at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com, contact us on Facebook at the SEA Travel Show, and look out for our daily travel insights podcast news on LinkedIn, the Southeast Asia Travel Show, and Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yeah, and meanwhile, if we haven't depressed you too much, you can catch up with our 34 previous episodes of the Southeast Asia Travel Show and 4 editions of the Friday Rewind Show on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, and Stitcher.
Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each one. And that's a wrap for this week. We'll be back later this week with edition 5 of the Friday Rewind Show. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you very soon.
Yeah, bye-bye.